I know I'm probably the only person who got very excited about Fawn Fable's cover of Yes's Wondrous Stories last year, this year, which is still happening, but I am still quite excited about it. Primitive Motion, God, that's a band that I wish I had noticed more when I first heard them 12 years ago when 2013's World's Floating By came out, but I never realized how much I loved this incredible duo out of Australia. Until a retrospective batch of recordings came out this year. We just heard them, Primitive Motion, from World's Floating By from 2013, the track Terminal Longings. We heard Crazy Dreams Band, that is Lexi Mountain on the crazy lead vocals, from their self-titled Holy Mountain release of 2009. The track was Separate Ways. Joe Bisso, from his excellent compilation of African disco experimentals from 1974 to 1978, we heard Don't Fight the Feeling. Tony Coulter, our very own, reading a story called Good Life from Bill Mack's 2008 WFMU Marathon Premium DJs at Play. And at the top of the set, John Waterman doing Listening to My Records from Fabio's Failure as an Oral Exciter. My name is Scott. Boy, it was exciting to be here with you today. I'm very happy to be back. And to say goodbye to 2025, hoping for the best for 2026. Do not let your hope die, friends. And hey, I'll see you then. Happy New Year. Bye. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM. Worldwide, online, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Tectonic is next.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. It's great to have you with me. Now, if you have listened to this show for any length of time, really, you've heard me talk about the exploitation that the big tech platforms exercise on the rest of us. There is a book out now that describes the history and the practice of this exploitation. This is a great book. We're going to be speaking today with Tim Wu, who's the author of the book, The Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered the Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity. It is talking about the exploitation, the extraction, the predatory behavior of the big tech platforms against the rest of us, which, you know, is a pretty constant theme of my comments and the interviews that are often on the show. So I'm really excited to share my conversation with Tim with you. He's also a professor at Columbia Law School and previously was a White House advisor under Biden. That comes up near the end of the talk. If you'd like links to Tim's work and this book and some other resources, go to the episode page at tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and you can find it all there. For now, let's go ahead and listen to my interview with Tim Wu here on Tectonic. Tim Wu, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you for having me on.
You're a Columbia law professor and a former White House official, and you've written an important book. It's called The Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered the Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity. It's not often that I agree with every last thing that an author says, but I read the whole thing and really appreciated it from cover to cover. Now, longtime listeners know that I have been warning for years about the extractive, predatory behavior of big tech, and this book explains clearly how it works. You write that over the last decade, the tech platforms have focused their attention on reforming their methods of extraction, taking as much as possible data, attention, profit margins from everyone else. How exactly does big tech carry out that extraction?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I want to highlight something you said first, which is the last decade. When I think about the history of big tech, if we're talking about the last, say, 20 years or so, I think you can kind of divide it into two: an early period that was more inventive. I would say more catalytic in the sense of they made a lot of stuff happen for a lot of other people, and ultimately healthier. The last decade, you know, say dating from early 2010s, has been a turn towards extraction. And also, an increasing year-by-year methods of trying to prevent people from leaving, as opposed to, you know, improving the core technologies or finding ways to make other people rich. So you can kind of divide it in two. I mean, how exactly does it happen? I think that's very dependent on the platform we're talking about. But if you wanted to speak at a more general level, there's a mixture of making sure people don't leave, whether through carrots or sticks or dependents and other forms, and then turning the dials on advertising and ad load, which is, you know, sort of the ad-driven ones, turning all the dials on fees, and also, I guess this is particularly important, a little complicated, turning the dials on the sellers or the advertising, you know, less the users to some extent, but also the people who sell on these platforms. So I guess that's a very high-level summary, but I'm happy to get into any individual platform if you want.
Well, let's talk about the idea of platforms, because the subtitle of the book refers to how tech platforms conquered the economy. In the book, you contrast the big tech platforms with a different and much older type of platform, which is the town square. You write about the genius of the ancient city square, citing examples like New York's Union Square, La Boqueria Market in Barcelona, and in London, Covent Garden. How do you compare these to the platforms of Silicon Valley?
Well, yeah, I felt it's important, given that the platforms play such a central role in our lives and our economies, that we try to understand what they are at the most fundamental level. And, you know, as you suggested, there have always been platforms in every civilization. A few weeks ago, I was in Rome and, you know, you go to the Forum, there it all is. It's kind of where everything takes place. You know, in some ways, our tech platforms are similar in the sense that they are places where things happen, but they're different in the following senses. First, the old city squares, main streets, fish markets and so off, very often had a very public aspect to them. They were either owned by the city or they had very strong regulation, even to say the stock market, for example, to make sure the market itself didn't take too much. And obviously we live in an age of private platforms that are profit maximizing and do everything they can to take from every possible transaction. I think obviously they're virtual and digital. Part of that gives them a sense that they're different. And I guess part of my book is just, you know, they're playing the same role the ancient platforms did. But most of all, there's sort of a difference in ambition. The idea, if there was an ambition of the city square, it was to anchor a great city and create a great, let's say the Roman Forum, was to try and anchor a great civilization and make it great. I think tech platforms want to take it all for themselves. They want to be the great ones. In the book, I describe them as having main character syndrome. You know, it's like they've forgotten they're supposed to make their civilization, their society great, and have become obsessed with themselves.
I saw you speak at a live event where you talked about this idea of the city squares and the fact that they're public and that they're neutral and have all these advantages over the tech platforms. And you brought up one sentence that's in the book somewhere that you said popped into mind as a summary or maybe a seed of the idea of the entire book. And the sentence is, everything needs to happen somewhere.
It is right. That's I think I was walking along 25th Street, in fact, when I was like, suddenly that sentence came to my head. And I was like, that's how I'll start the book. All right, something has to happen. Everything has to happen somewhere. And I meant it as, in my mind, kind of a rejoinder to the sense that transactions, speech, all the things we care about just kind of happen. You know, they have to occur somewhere. And in my mind, the places that things happen has a very powerful role in determining what kind of civilization or society we live in. You know, for example, if we think about speech, to the degree we have places for free speech, like this particular radio show we're on right now, it leads to a kind of a different kind of civilization, while one where there isn't places for free speech. I think that's obvious. Things happen to happen somewhere. And I feel that, you know, as I wrote in this book, our time, we have allowed what are essentially the public spaces, the places that things happen, to be controlled by an extraordinarily small number of actors. It'll just take one example, our, you know, so-called great public square, which was Twitter, which is sort of relied upon by everyone. We sort of let a random billionaire buy it. I mean, I can't imagine ancient Rome or ancient Greece, they just let one guy suddenly control the town square and say, okay, now he's in charge. And, you know, I think just maybe the emperor would be crazy, but just to let that randomly happen is just unthinkable. So I guess it's kind of to remember a sense of place and how much that matters for how we live.
This problem of concentration of power is a recurring theme in the book. And I liked how you contextualized it, that we have seen this problem before. We have lived through this before. You have a quote from 1911. This is Supreme Court Justice John Marshall Harlan writing about what he called a kind of slavery that threatened the American people. Quote, "The slavery that would result from aggregations of capital in the hands of a few individuals and corporations, controlling for their own profit and advantage exclusively the entire business of the country." Now, here we are a century later, we're facing the same threat. And I wanted to ask, how severe really is the concentration of wealth today due to big tech? And is it even worse than it was 100 years ago?
Justice Harlan was one of the country's great anti-monopolists. And one of the things I've been trying to do with this book, and also with my other work, honestly, over the last decade and a half, is revitalize the American tradition of anti-monopoly. And I think we've had some success. I think it's fair to say there's a movement that has some real power to it, though we've had setbacks. And I think it is our economic conditions that is adding fuel to the fire of anti-monopoly right now. We are, I think, in a very similar situation to that of about 125 years ago, where we faced very stark levels of inequality. I actually would say that they were worse then, in the sense that there are people starving now, but there were, I think, a lot of people starving then. And, you know, I would be exaggerating to say things are worse now on a basic needs basis. I mean, the factory workers, no protections at all. Unions, back then, it was not unusual to bust a union by hiring a private army and firing on them, you know, with actual weapons. And people thought that was fine. So, you know, in some ways, things were even more brutal. But the similarities are there, too. That was a time of incredible wealth imbalance and also extraordinary anger and political foment. And around the world, the rise of fascist, proto-fascist, anarchist, and communist revolutionary movements basically formed of people who were angry. And that's why I think we really need to deal with the imbalance of economic power in our time or face the consequences. In some ways, I think we are living through the consequences. We have a rise of populist anger, unlike anything else I've experienced in my life. It goes in random directions. It goes to the election, you know, of radical proto-fascist style politicians, both here and in other countries. So yeah, I think we're in a very similar kind of situation, and I feel like we have to try to do something or face the consequences.
Okay, I want to dive into how this problem is exhibiting itself and what some of the solutions might be. But before we get into the bad stuff, I just wanted to return to something you brought up earlier, which was that brief moment of tech optimism around the birth of the web. And you actually write about this in the book. You have a chapter called The Golden Age of Tech Optimism. In that chapter, you write, "The extent of tech optimism over the late 1990s and early 2000s is hard to overstate." I can verify that's true because I was there just starting out in my own career and was very much a tech optimist. Like so many of my peers, I believed in, as you put it, a decentralized future in which the Goliaths didn't stand a chance. We thought the web would bring about a flourishing of creativity and democracy and opportunity of all kinds. And of course, it all went wrong. But before we go there, I wanted to ask, what was your experience like, Tim, in the late 90s? Were you one of the starry-eyed believers?
Absolutely. I was a true believer, even going back to the 80s, honestly. Back in the 1980s, my mother bought us an Apple computer, and my brother and I learned to program it. And we thought this was a device, you know, like a miracle device. In some ways, we were talking about Cory Doctorow before the show. Cory and I were friends. And, you know, we were part of a kind of a group of geeks that just, you know, believed there was something magical here. Our parents were people from the 60s and 70s. And the sense moving to the personal computer, the internet, was that the progressive kind of human potential movement ideal of those days was finally becoming flesh. Now we're moving forward to the internet. You know, the whole idea in some ways of the 70s is that, you know, inside every single person there was, this sounds really cheesy, but like, you know, a flower waiting to bloom, or like, you know, some possibility and some potential, and like whether it was singing your own song or writing your own thing or whatever it was, there was like enough for everyone, and we were going to live in this flourishing land. And the early web in some ways really captured that feeling in the sense that it was open. There was, you know, a million flowers blooming. Everybody felt more or less equal. You know, a random blogger felt no different than a news site in a way that didn't seem bad. I mean, now that seems kind of bad because of the war for attention. But at the time, it just seemed amazing. And underlying it all, just to turn back to the platform, was this belief in a kind of beneficent internet. The web, of course, was created by Tim Berners-Lee, who was a very altruistic guy. And people were always saying things like, you know, the web, it's all about sharing. It's an act of love. I think Clay Shirky, still obviously very active, said that, yeah, the web is built on acts of love and everybody contributing. And it was great. And it was exciting and weird. And I think we just thought things would get better and better. Then we ran into a few turning points.
Yeah. See, understatement of the day. I'm calling it now. So let's move on to what went wrong. I actually found a good summary of what happened in another book of yours. This is your 2016 book, The Attention Merchants, which I also read and I also really enjoyed. This is what you wrote. The idealists had hoped the web would be different, and it certainly was for a time, but over the long term, it would become something of a 99-cent store, if not an outright cesspool. As with the demolition of Penn Station, a great architectural feat had been defaced for little in return. And I read those words, and it's interesting to me that that was published back in 2016. From that point to today, how did the tech companies use platform power to make the internet so, so much worse?
Yeah, well, if you don't mind, can I back up even a little further?
Sure.
Because by 2016, we've already gotten kind of past some of the points of no return, I guess. I won't say no return, but we are kind of, I mean, I think Age of Optimism has its first kind of kinks in the road, really in the early 2000s. And this is something else I talk about in the book. To me, it comes down to the decision of the major, most optimistic tech platforms, and I guess particularly, I think Google, and to some degree, Twitter, a little later, to just take the standard US corporate form with its demands for quarterly revenue, shareholder welfare, and the rest of it. And to me, it's rooted in this, I guess, sometimes American, definitely Silicon Valley, idea that, you can have it all, that there's no trade-offs. All the founders get to be billionaires, but then also they get to save the world and have these companies that act like nonprofits. And, like that kind of thing worked for a little while. And Google kind of was like a little bit like a nonprofit, maybe for the first like 8 years of its existence, and did allow its engineers to like spend huge amounts of their time on random projects that went nowhere and attracted a lot of very idealistic people, many of them like friends of mine and colleagues at law school, places like that, kind of got a lot of people into their orbit. But that decision, the sort of structural decision, was ultimately fatal to these kind of idealistic ambitions. I contrast them to some degree with Wikipedia, which to my mind is one of the last parts of the old internet, where they decided to go nonprofit and rely on fundraising, which works. And Wikipedia is a terrific, it's not perfect, it has its flaws and fights, but whatever. But I mean, it's not some evil extractive empire that is trying to like survey your children for profit or something like that, or promote fascist theories or anything like that. Just this kind of site. And part of it, I think, is I have to give Jimmy Wales credit, which is he could have, become a billionaire, pushed some little button and rolled his board like Sam Altman did and just turned it into a nonprofit. Sorry, turned it into a profit and made himself rich, but he didn't. And I give him a lot of credit. I just think it was a tragic error that more of these idealistic platforms didn't make themselves into nonprofit platforms. So, yeah, that's rolling back a little bit, but I think that was a key turning point.
You mentioned Sam Altman, and just to make sure listeners know, Sam Altman is the CEO of OpenAI that makes ChatGPT. OpenAI was originally founded as a nonprofit. Interestingly enough, co-founded by Elon Musk, who's also the founder of something called Grokopedia, which he hopes will dethrone Wikipedia, but that's another story. But OpenAI, the original conception was that it was going to be almost like a Wikipedia. It was going to be a nonprofit that used AI to the point of the name OpenAI. It was going to allow everybody to experience the benefits of AI without a profit motive. And boy, that changed pretty quick.
It did. Well, it did take 5, 6 years. I guess Sam Altman, who you identified as the CEO, made the opposite decision of Jimmy Wales, decided that, history couldn't live without him being, I mean, he was already rich, but like even wealthier or more directed than ever before. I mean, in a sense, it's a pity that we have a system that the default is you become, a company that needs to constantly make itself worse in order to make more money. And, the writing is on the wall with OpenAI. They have to, turn to this extraction phrase and start sucking up money. And it is really a tragedy. We sort of rely on the idea that we're going to have someone like Jimmy Wales, who's altruistic and, is okay being a hundred, making hundreds of millions of dollars, not billions. It speaks to the need for structural reform.
Yeah, and I think we should be clear here, Tim, that in this book, you're not advocating that everybody go out and start nonprofits and resist the siren song for money for the rest of their career. I think, and you can tell me if I'm reading this right, what you're advocating for is, as you said, structural reform that allows for opportunity, allows for entrepreneurs to go out and build companies, platforms, whatever, could make some money. But there are certain things that they're not allowed to do.
Yeah.
Can you say more about that?
Sure. Well, let me back up and say, and here I kind of agree with some of the abundance people. That's a code word, I guess, for people, for a group of people who have said, have taken that that word on. By the tech revolution, there has been the creation of an enormous potential for wealth through the increases in productivity and, you know, engines of search and just everything that is marvelous about digital technology that could make everybody very wealthy. But we have made this very strange decision, in my view, to have the sector be monopolized and have much of it be extracted by a small number. I think, you know, in a different world, let's say, where Amazon, let's say, as opposed to taking over 50, 60% of every sale, took 20%, I think that we could have a nation full of wealthy small business people, entrepreneurs, people selling their stuff. It's the fact that the platforms are sucking from every single transaction in order to pile up tens of billions, trillions of dollars in wealth. And it's just a crazy misallocation. And so what I want, I can get into more detail. I just am deeply a believer in a rebalancing of the economy and a broader prosperity. I think profit is a very motivating thing. And I think it's great to have a nation with a lot of wealthy people. And I think actually we have enough means for everybody to have plenty.
Let's talk about that Amazon example you brought up, because sure. You have a pretty detailed case study of Amazon Marketplace, which initially showed a lot of promise. So the idea was that small businesses could list their products on Amazon Marketplace and use that platform to have a viable lifestyle business. Instead, it has devolved. Cory Doctorow would say it has, well, I can't say the word on the radio, but it has infecalized to the extent that, as you write in the book, Tim, sellers and users of Amazon Marketplace are now spending nearly $56 billion a year in order to make the buying experience worse. How yeah. did we get to this sorry state of affairs?
Yes. So Amazon is good to focus on because in some ways it represents that early dream of the internet to which I spoke about. I say that because it is actually the world's most sophisticated, largest marketplace, the human history's most sophisticated, largest marketplace where sellers can go and sell stuff to an enormous audience. And so in that is the formula for a lot of wealth being spread to a lot of people. And the way the Amazon marketplace worked, in some ways it was that place, say in 2010 or so, 2012, Amazon had, by that point, mastered or figured out order fulfillment so it could ship people's products for them. It's a big invention. And its margins were reasonable, less than 20, sometimes as low as 15% of an order. So it motivated and created the opportunity for kind of a middle class, and by this I mean an independent class of people who would sell their own stuff. There's a lot of stories in the book. One of them is Barber in Indiana, who started selling his own pomade on the side, and it took off, and he started making a lot of money, and eventually, you know, was making like $1 million a year or something like that, selling this pomade. What happened is that once Amazon gathered and grouped all the sellers and gathered most of the buyers, locked in both sides, both pay prime fees, and also just by sheer size of the marketplace, it became implausible for sellers to go other places if they were trying to seek a large audience. Then Amazon just started turning the screws one after another. And one of the most dramatic, to my mind, is the particular fee you referred to, which Amazon calls advertising. What it really is that sponsored result thing you see when you are searching for something. Maybe you're looking for, I don't know, holiday lights or something like that, and you see, you know, sponsored result. Seems just like a weird internet trick. So those results are bid upon by sellers and they cost a fortune because I guess, you know, the first search result is clicked on the most. And as you said, in total, in the year 2024, it hit $56 billion in revenue, which is more than three times the revenue of every newspaper on earth. No, more than double the revenue of every newspaper on earth. So you could, you know, triple the number of newspapers on earth, or you could have sponsored results. And, you know, it just is this enormous cash grab that makes search worse because it makes it harder to find stuff. You're never quite sure. So we as customers and as sellers, we are paying $56 billion a year to make the product worse. And a classic kind of sterling example of valueless data, a value extraction, just a pure extraction. And I feel like, you know, the online world has become full of things like that, just stuff that its only function is not actually to add any value, but to extract. And maybe that is the pure definition of extraction, is you offer something that has no value, no added value, but merely takes more money from both sides of the market.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Tim Wu, the author of the book, The Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered the Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity. And now you're seeing, as I said in my intro, how this book is detailing how big tech carries out its predatory behavior on the rest of us. And I'll admit, it's a little bit grim. I mean, these are multi-trillion dollar companies that are oriented towards, as Tim puts it, extraction, extracting all the value out of the system, away from you and towards themselves. But don't worry, in the second half of the interview coming up, you're going to hear a little bit of good news, a little bit of hope. I always try to leaven the bad news with some possible good news, and we do get there, don't worry. If you'd like links to the book and other resources, go to the episode page at tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Tim Wu, author of The Age of Extraction, here on Tectonic. I like how you're contrasting throughout this book these different approaches. You know, extraction, as you say, adds no value versus an approach like Jimmy Wales at Wikipedia that doesn't extract from people, instead offers value to the world. Another interesting contrast I saw in the book had to do with a 19th century admiral. This is English Admiral Robert Fitzroy, who was somewhat well known for being the captain of the Beagle, which was the ship famous for Charles Darwin's five-year voyage in the 1830s. But Fitzroy is also known today as a pioneer of weather forecasting. And weather forecasting provides this contrast I'm bringing up to the big tech platforms. As you write, Fitzroy's forecasting of the weather was given to the public, a tradition that continues. Yet today, many of the most advanced predictions regarding human behavior are generated using methods mainly kept secret, using data privately held, and with results that are usually kept private. So here, in this all-important skill in the digital economy of prediction, we have weather prediction, which is public, while the prediction of people and people's behavior as carried out on the tech platforms is private.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, prediction in many ways is the magic power of our times. Weather prediction before Fitzroy and before sort of science got better was often the domain of actual wizards and witches who would rely on frogs and other sort of things. It's always had this kind of the ability to see the future, even in kind of a blurry way, has always been very tempting to humans. What is crazy is today that we have some of it, more than you like to say. It is an extraordinary power. And we use it mainly to generate better advertising results and convince people to buy things. And we use it for AI products in order to generate convincing levels of speech. But as you point out, the bulk of it is not public at all or devoted to a public purpose, but ultimately designed to enhance the extractive powers of the tech platforms. And that's particularly the advertising side. I mean, AI is in this somewhat more scientific period where they're trying to improve AI, but it's, you know, with the amount being spent and the stock valuations behind it, the extractive age of AI is just around the corner. And I kind of tremble with fear of what that's going to look like, to be honest. Unless something happens around the corner, I dread there is strong effort to try and figure out how you justify these hundreds of billions in spending that just went on.
Oh, sure. They're going to need to turn to extraction in desperation to try to juice as much profit as they can. The investment is just too large. Recently, we've been hearing these hype-filled announcements about AI agents. I'll just give one small slice of their possible use. The companies say there's going to be shopping agents that you'll be able to give them a prompt, and they'll go out and, purchase or bring back for your approval whatever junk that you're interested in buying, as though the agent is actually going to operate in the consumer's best interest. After all, these agents are being built by the same companies that have shown extraction to be their goal in all other areas of operation. So why would we think that this latest new shiny thing of AI agents is going to be anything but an extractive method for big tech?
I mean, I think this is one of my main complaints about our current generation of technologies. And I say this as someone, as I said earlier, who, loved computers growing up, loves tools, loves technology. The thing with most human tools, old school tools, is they basically work for you and don't have other motives. Like, if you have a hammer, like it doesn't suddenly try to sell you on some kind of like extension or only work certain times of the day. It's just, you hammer a nail and it works, and you can develop kind of a bond with your hammer or your other tools. I mean, I have tools I love. A hammer, when I cook, you have a really good sharp knife. It's under your control. It does what you say. It's very faithful. Today, contrast that experience, sort of your physical tools for when you walk up to your computer screen and you try to like start using search or Amazon search and all kinds of randomness. And suddenly you have this feeling that it's like, you really can't trust this thing. You have to be constantly trying to keep it on course. You sit down, you have one thing you want to do. Next thing let's say you want to buy a pair of slippers because your feet are cold. All of a sudden you find yourself like off on some, it's kind of tricked you, or you've gotten sidetracked and you're, off examining, the merits of some kind of sock or whatever else, or online gambling. You have this very, just, we live in a generation of tools that cannot be trusted, is what I'm trying to say, that are always kind of turning on us and then charging us more or tricking us. I kind of, and I think it drives people crazy. It's like living with people who lie to you all the time. One of the things, sometimes you'll travel another country and you have a tour guide, and then they're like, I'm going to take you to see the pyramids or whatever. And the next thing you end up at the gift store. I mean, that's kind of our lives right now. You're like, wait, I wanted to do this thing, and why are we doing this other thing? But it's subtle, and these things are really useful, so they're hard to deal without. And I think AI, you brought up agentic AI. I mean, I would love it. I think Olive would love it if we had suddenly had some truly loyal butler who went out and filed my expense reports, or I'm trying to think, in some really faithful way, acted in your interest, really figured out what you like to eat. But you don't, I wouldn't think it's like, yeah, sure. They're going to negotiate some kind of deal where I pay twice as much. So I'm not trusting them. So then you're working, then you end up doing 10 times as much work trying to overcome the biases of your agent. You end up working more in order to try to figure out whether they're being cheated or not, or you sit back and you get cheated. And like that kind of thing, that's like where we've ended up in our times.
And people may wonder, why did we have to end up this way? Why is agentic AI likely to be so untrustworthy? And it's, I mean, from the title of your book, this is all about extraction. By doing this, the companies that are acting as monopolies, they're able to juice their profits just a little bit more. You write that that has been such a profitable approach for Silicon Valley that, and this is even worse news, and I'm sorry to have to report this to everyone, but you write in the book that this approach is now spreading to industries beyond tech. You write about how the big tech model of platform monopolies is being adopted in industries like healthcare and housing. You point out the role of private equity, which I've covered on the show, in bringing this about. What's an example of how private equity is going into these industries to make them act more like Silicon Valley?
Yeah, I would say that private equity's business model, when it has, part of it has to do with tax forms, the various forms of tax evasion. But when it's not about that, typically borrowing somewhat from the tech industry, it has to do with identifying areas where for some norms or custom or something has kept people back from maximal extraction. You know, it could be, for example, the pharmaceutical industry, where at one point it was considered unethical to, you know, charge a dying person massive amounts of money for medicine. Some of the ones I cover in my book have to do with the platformization of medical practices and of housing. Medical practices, just take one example, a private equity figured out that, you know, doctors, even though they make quite a bit of money, could take even more from the system. And in fact, they could take more private equity from the system by organizing medicine and buying up practices. And in some ways, turning doctors into their employees, although they flatter them more than that, and taking a lot from them and from patients and just sucking more out of the system, particularly in fields like anesthesiology, where it's not exactly optional. You know, it's not a luxury good or something you just pass on. Housing, I think, in some ways is broader. We've seen since the Great Recession, the spread of models of just very organized corporate landlords who, landlords have always wanted more money. Okay, fair enough. But they're not that organized. Sometimes they maybe feel guilty about a poor family that can't afford the rent. But a corporate landlord owning tens of thousands, hundreds, millions of homes, just systematically buying them all up, organizing them with software, raising rents without any kind of hesitation or compassion or a sense of it's effect, just the amount, the maximum, raising every fee you can. I think that has driven, that kind of organization of housing is one of the things driving the affordability crisis in our times. And it comes from that same problem, frankly, that business people in our time have really changed the way they think about how you make a career in business. I feel that, and maybe it's sort of an innocent thing to think, but at one point, you know, the idea of business was to create a new product and make a decent amount of money from it. And, you know, that's what you did. And maybe a new product or better branding or something, you know. But I feel that today has much less to do with improving a product or something and more about finding weak points where people are trapped one way or another and you can turn the screws on them. or it's another industry you can get. I frankly like doctors or vets. Veterinarians over the last 10 years or so have increasingly been bought up by private equity practices who notice that, like, vets weren't necessarily working that hard. And so they just, you know, increase the hours. And they also notice the clients don't necessarily complain. And you can make a lot more out of, you can upcode, or you can basically just make a lot more money treating people's dogs and cats and animals. So looking for those kind of opportunities is the name of the game in American business these days. And I think it's really been a turn for the worse and one that has generated a lot of the unaffordability that you hear about and a lot of the complaints about the nature of work.
All right. So next time you feel the screws being tightened on you, whether it's in healthcare or housing or indeed on the big tech platforms that we've been talking about, you at least know a little more where it comes from and how it works. And that brings up the last question or two, Tim, around solutions. I mean, I always like to try to find some good news or some hope that people can hold on to because there's no lack of bad news and scary possibilities that surround us every day. In this book, you're writing about the value and the importance of antitrust, which I totally agree with. And as you said earlier, you've worked quite a bit on that, the importance of unions in order to create what you call a balanced economy. And then there's one other possible solution that I think applies in particular to some of these big tech monopolies. You write, when all else fails, the answer, admittedly a last resort, is to declare an essential platform to be a utility and place a hard cap on what the platform can take from the rest of the economy. So you can imagine if there was a utility for, I don't know, search or something like that, in the same way that we have electricity and the phone network as utilities, how would that work with the big tech platforms?
Yeah, I've increasingly come to think that we need a new generation of utility laws. And we live in a time where it's as if we've allowed, you know, the electric company and the toll bridge company or whatever to just charge whatever they want. And, you know, that's fine. Obviously the electric network's essential, but no one would say, well, okay, therefore they get whatever they want. And not only that, that we're going to, as the tech companies often say, if you like, don't let us make all the money we want, we won't invent the future. I mean, the electric company could have said that too, but we'd say like, you know, just keep supplying electricity. That's what we want you to do. So we need to identify the parts of the online economy that resemble, frankly, electricity or utility-like status. I mean, the Amazon marketplace is not a bad place to start. Commerce depends on it. You can't just tell the sellers, oh, you know, go sell everything on Etsy or something, which is much smaller. We have some competition, but not really enough. And the Europeans have gone in this direction. We need to declare certain companies in a size, reach, and essentialness that they are utility platforms and place a hard cap, say, okay, Amazon, you know, 30%, that's what you get. I mean, you used to do it for 20%, but let's say 30%. I guess I'm being generous. You still make billions of dollars. You still make fortunes. You just don't have extra trillions of dollars laying around. And the rest of the economy, everyone else selling on Amazon, people buying on Amazon, suddenly are a little bit wealthier. You know, these utilities are kind of like a private tax on the economy. I guess same thing comes with advertising on apparently the undislodgeable monopolies of advertising. Unfortunately, I feel like the antitrust effort to try to break some of the power in the advertising area, Google and Facebook, is having mixed results. And at some point, I guess you could just say, listen, here's the price, or these are the terms you're going to deal on, and you can't preference yourself. And, you know, we just think you're taking too much from the rest of the economy. So those are two examples. Obviously, you have to do it well. Obviously, it wouldn't be very popular. But the most important thing to understand is it is, in a weird way, very pro-business. It's just not pro-platform. But it's a very pro-business thing to prevent this private tax from being inflicted on every other part of the economy.
Yeah, you're very generous in suggesting 30%. I was going to open with 2.5% and be willing to go up to 3, but that's how I feel about Amazon. I did want to ask you about antitrust. You, as I said in the introduction, you're a former White House advisor under Biden. You were working on antitrust issues. Under the current occupant, seems like a lot of the antitrust activity has slowed or even halted. We no longer have Lina Khan, whose work I love, at the FTC. I know she's now working with the incoming New York mayor. What is the future of antitrust?
That is a question that many of us are waiting to find the answer to, honestly. I think the current administration is really not consistent in this area and is unclear. So I think many people may assume that the administration just dropped everything, but they kept the main cases against big tech going. Honestly, the Republican Party has also been critical of the extractive, you know, to be fair, they're very confused because they have been critical of the extractive part of big tech. And I think there's a lot of voters in red states who are like, gosh, these guys are making a lot of money and we're not. And this is kind of unfair. I mean, they have a legitimate, you know, I'm a Democrat, obviously, but I would say that people in the center of the country have a legitimate beef with how things have gone over the last 20 years. So the administration is a cipher. They've kept the cases going. The problem is, you know, without getting too far into politics, I think they've shown themselves to be relatively open to offers of large sums of money, or like, you know, hiring of family members or sponsoring of cryptocurrencies or whatever kind of little things that amount to a payoff. So I'm very worried that the power of corruption is greater than the power of populism, especially in the second term. So I guess I've been worried. Honestly, there have been two decisions that have gone against the anti-monopoly movement, one in Facebook, one in Google. So Google, we sued Google for monopolizing search. And by we, I mean, I actually started during Trump too. We doubled down in Biden and won the case. But the judge at the last minute, when there was supposed to be a big Google breakup, lost his nerve and basically very much weakened the final remedy, such that it's basically a more, pretty much a slap on the wrist. It's a real tragedy. Frankly, it's an Obama-appointed judge. I don't like politicizing the judiciary, but it is like I can't say, oh, this is some crazy right-wing Trump judge or something. It's like Obama-era guy who just got nervous that I guess maybe he was going to stop the future of AI or whatever form of propaganda he listened to. And then the Facebook case was dismissed by another judge. Based on the idea that Facebook isn't a monopoly, which was, so he dismissed Lina Khan's case. So there's been some real setbacks in this area. I still believe in anti-monopoly, but I have started to sort of lean more heavily on the idea that we need utility laws or something else. I mean, most of all, when I look back at it, the federal government has actually done almost nothing over 20 years of the growth of monopoly power. One thing, so optimistic, pessimistic, that's pretty unfortunate. It's clear that there's a giant imbalance. I think anyone on the street would say, does the American economy seem fair or does it seem a little imbalanced? It's not even a hard question. What gives me optimism is that we have, in the history of this country, had movements that have restored balance. The progressive era was one that took place. The movement took place during a period of extraordinary imbalance we talked about, and resulted in more powerful unions, better minimum wage laws, protections for workers, and a huge antitrust campaign, and the utility laws, a lot of stuff. The New Deal did another, it just took everything further. So we've done this before, we can do it again, but we need to turn the corner somehow and change this culture that says that the tech industry is somehow immune to human laws. That's doing a lot of damage in our time.
Yeah, and as I often say on the show, whatever solution we eventually come to, the first step is awareness. People need to understand how these platforms work and how they're exploiting everyone and holding us back from real progress. And this book is an excellent distillation of the history and the current issues and the possible solutions. The book is called The Age of Extraction: How Tech Platforms Conquered the Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity by you, Tim Wu. Tim, great job on the book. Thanks so much for taking this time today, and I hope you'll be back.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. And if I can say just one last word, I mean, it's not like these platforms are useless. I mean, they're very convenient, effective, but I just really want your listeners to understand how much of a tax they're imposing on our entire country and how much wealth is being taken through their usage. So don't want you to say like, oh my God, I hate using Google, because of course it's very useful. But the question is, how much are we paying for that utility in our time? And that's what we need, frankly, government to solve for us. So thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll remain your host for the remaining few minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Tim Wu, author of the book, The Age of Extraction: How Tech Platforms Conquered the Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity. There's a link to the book and some links to other resources on the episode page, which is at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. And I just want to say thanks again to Tim Wu for talking with me about his book and some of the themes and what he sees as the future of antitrust. It was just a great conversation. And as I think you could tell, I'm enthusiastic about this book. It's definitely one of the best tech books that I've read in a while. I also appreciated that Tim mentioned his long friendship with Cory Doctorow, another author and speaker and past guest of this show. You can see a parallel between what Tim is talking about in The Age of Extraction and how Cory Doctorow writes about a similar problem, which he calls the word that I can't say on the radio, but we'll call it enfecalization, which is to say essentially the platform decay, the degradation of the tech platforms as they grow and intensify the exploitation they carry out on users and business partners and employees and everybody, all getting mistreated to the benefit of eight dudes on the west coast of the U.S. and their feudal vassals. We really are entering into a feudal system that benefits a tiny, tiny group of people at the expense of everybody else. So I would recommend reading the book and gaining some better awareness about how these tech monopolies act against your interests, against your community's interests, and get some ideas about what we can do to fight back. As always, if you want more resources and more past shows with Cory Doctorow and other people, you can find them all at the Tectonic website at tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. That's about all the time I have for you today. I do have some homework for next time. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. And I wish all of you a very happy new year, depending on when you're listening to this, but I wish you all the best in 2026. Thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time, friends. Hope you have a great week.
absolutely crazy. That track sounds as crazy today in the waning days of 2025 as it did in 1971. I'll tell you. Good evening, folks. You're listening now to It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday right here in the New Jersey City studios of WFMU, listener-supported WFMU. This show is an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. If you don't know what that means, that's okay. You'll find out soon enough. And, you know, people do, a lot of people, a lot of DJs, a lot of my colleagues here do special shows for the holidays, and especially around the end of the year, because, well, it's just an obvious time to do specials. People do wrap-ups, you know, favorite albums of the year, whatever. I don't do that. I don't do Halloween specials, nothing, just because. Why? Because I'm lazy. That's why. And also, I always come in here every week dressed up like the New Year's baby, wearing a diaper with a sash over my shoulder that says 2026 on it. That's just the way I roll here every week in Studio A here at FMU. So it's just another show for me. And we're going to start it today with some jazz. Now, I occasionally go overboard talking about how the sort of concept behind prog rock and the kind of stuff that I focus on this show is sort of mostly, kind of, mainly, most of all, a rock invention. And jazz, as super, super complex as it got, in the days of bebop, whatever, in the 40s and later 50s, 60s, jazz musicians just generally didn't do a lot of the kinds of super complex rhythmic stuff that prog rock bands did, starting in the late 60s, early 70s, whatever. But of course, there were a lot of jazz musicians doing plenty of weird rhythmic stuff and playing in strange time signatures and whatnot. There are some obvious ones. Of course, the one everyone always mentions first is Take Five by Dave Brubeck, but there are lots of others. So I'm going to play a track now with that long-winded introduction. I'm going to play something from Charlie Rouse. This is a great, great track from a 1974 release, the title track from a 1974 release called Two is One. And it was released on the Strata East label, a great, what's generally referred to as spiritual jazz label. Anything, pretty much, on Strata East is worth your time. And this was a Strata East release. This track is, it's kind of long at 11 minutes or so, and goes through a whole bunch of odd time signatures, and it's just a great piece. It starts in nine-eighths, if I remember correctly, goes to seven, just all over the place, and it's a really good piece, and very proggy, you might say. So here's Charlie Rouse with the track Two is One.